Hi, Bomb Squad. Welcome to Food for Thought, a Radio Cherry Bomb miniseries. I'm Carrie Diamond, editor-in-chief of Cherry Bomb magazine. We wanted to know what's on the mind of food folk across the country, so we went on tour to eat, drink, and talk with hundreds of you and recorded the whole thing live. Today's stop brings us to Philadelphia, where we recorded at the new brewery, Triple Bottom Brewing. Thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our Food for Thought tour. Kerrygold is the Irish brand known for its award-winning butter and cheese, made with milk from grass-fed cows, from family farms all over Ireland. We'll be hearing more about their amazing products later, so stay tuned. First up, we'll hear from Alexis Siemens, a tea expert who tells us a little bit about what she calls pre-eating.
Before I jump into my story, I just want to have a quick tea PSA because I have to just share a little blurb. First and foremost, if you are making matcha at home, definitely sift it first. I know this seems like a crazy extra step because it's powder, but it's a game changer, I promise, even if it's like a little tea infuser. And use the bamboo whisk. It will just add the beautiful frothy texture that you cannot otherwise get. Step two, if you're going to be steeping tea, really good tea, make sure you're paying attention to the steep time and the water temperature. Makes a huge difference in the flavor. And finally, number three, if you have dried fruit or dried mushrooms at home, rehydrate them with tea and then use that broth to cook grains and then reincorporate that dried fruit or dried mushrooms back into the dish. So that's kind of a fun way to use them. Okay, had to get that off my chest. So now I'm gonna tell you a little story. So let's take a trip back to the mid-90s when my teenage self learned the art of eating from a fax machine. For the millennials in the audience, or younger millennials, a fax machine is a very, very loud beeping noise. I actually had it on my phone, but I thought it was a little annoying to play, so just Google it afterwards. So I can still hear the low beeping hum of the fax machine as it slowly printed the menu being sent from Italy to my childhood home in New Jersey. "Don't pick it up," my father yelled from the kitchen as the fax line rang. My 13-year-old self, most likely mid-eye roll, since the fax line was my unofficial phone line to discuss episodes of Friends, was totally unaware of the magic that was about to evolve. As my dad carefully tore the long stream of fax paper from the machine, his eyes lit up with excitement as he studied the tissue-thin paper with faint ink, revealing Italian words describing primi, secondi, and dolci on the menu. My father was planning an edible adventure, our first family vacation to Italy, that we were about to embark upon 6 months later. Keep in mind that this was pre-travel site, pre-Instagram, and pre-anything that we now enjoy to plan our restaurant rendezvous. He was studying the menus of Italian restaurants, digesting every word so that he could carefully plan our taste bud route. This was the moment I understood the art of eating, or rather, pre-eating. The anticipation was the imaginative amuse-bouche, the wonder of the unknown versus the instant gratification of liking a photo of tonight's special. After an hour or so of curving up a hill towards a small town near Florence, we settled our near-nauseous stomachs with the crisp yet tender Tuscan bread, being reminded to save room. I can still remember peering around the restaurant with a sense of wonder. Take a moment. Imagine picking up a telephone to make a reservation without ever reading countless articles about the chef, without ever seeing tagged interior photos on Instagram and wondering if you'll be seated by the window with the good light, without checking on James Beard Awards, just showing up, living in the moment. Maybe there's a way to strike a balance where we can be informed and still leave a little room for the childhood joy of surprise. While I can't recall what I ate that evening tucked in the tiny Tuscan town, I do remember the feeling. I knew that what I was experiencing was special and that it should be savored. There was an art to pre-eating that sent my taste buds into a triumphant tizzy of the unexpected before every bite. A few years ago, while tumbling back through a myriad of memories, I made a point to tell my parents how I learned the art of pre-eating through a fax machine. Days later, they presented me with a copy of the printed menu from that very Italian restaurant that I recalled. They had saved it as a souvenir. Carefully rolled into a scroll and then tied with a deep emerald green ribbon, the menu appeared more like a treasure map, which was quite fitting considering the circumstances. While the fax machine print was most likely swept away in a move from our childhood home, this tangible paper carried a feeling, a sense of place, and a reminder to still leave a little room for a bit of the unknown, some food for thought. To this day, I still find immense joy perusing menus leading up to the delight of dining so that I can begin my edible adventure well before my reservation. I try to only look at their Instagram page one time, maybe a week before, just so that I can experience that sense of wonder. So I leave you with a question. Do you remember your first momentous meal? What delicious details do you recall, and how did they make you feel? Carry that remarkable sense of discovery with you, and your heart will always be full. Thank you.
Thank you, Alexis, for both your tea tips and your insight. Next, we'll hear from Jill Weber. Jill is an archaeologist and the restaurateur behind the Sojourn Philly Restaurant Group. Curious how those two professions go together? Let's find out.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Jill Weber, an archaeologist, and who also became a restaurateur. Now, how did that happen? That's the question. Well, to start, careers in archaeology and careers in restaurants have something in common: the need to be comfortable with the chaotic and the unknown. Archaeology taught me to love chaos and to always, always, always seek the unknown. I grew up too poor to travel, but was always drawn to colors, all of them, names, Isfahan, and tastes, persimmon, that were unfamiliar to me. Archaeology meant free travel, and for my first excavation, I flew to Turkey. Arriving in Istanbul as a 21-year-old, my very first time out of the States, I knew that this was actually for me. This felt right. Adventure was here, in the boisterous bazaar, with vibrant colors everywhere, street vendors selling sesame rolls, mussels, dried apricots, rose petals, tamarind, tea, juice, coffee, everything you can imagine, and everybody yelling. This really felt right to me. As an archaeologist, I stay for several months at a time in a foreign place, living among people who see and smell and taste and make different spices, odors, perfumes, and food. Yet for all those differences, including those of language and cultural norms, there's inclusion and sharing in food that makes these new experiences intoxicating, happy, and addictive. It hardly matters what country one is from, what language one speaks, what culture one is visiting. In every culture I've ever been in, I've been brought into the fold by women bringing me food. So in Turkey, we'd gather to henna our hair, drink pots and pots and pots of tea, eat helva, pistachios, olives, and bread. In Kurdistan, it was a mother and a daughter squatting over a propane tank, making shifta, Kurdish meat patties. In Syria, it'd be guests from Mensef, huge platters of rice with raisins and almonds and whole roasted lambs, complete with their big fat tails and their skulls still full of all their organs. I adore lamb, and I learned to love lamb brain, sitting on carpets and cushions on the floor, scooping brain out of the skull with a piece of bread and adding some roasted almond for crunch. That's how my host did it. That's how I did it. While I reveled in tasting these new and exciting flavors, I was even more infatuated by food as a vehicle for connecting to people, cultures, and new perspectives. It can be surprising to people that I so flourished in these settings and feel completely at home in Arab and Muslim worlds. After all, these are places that some expect to be stiflingly conservative toward women. But culture is not monolithic. It obviously depends on where you are, and the reality is quite different. Syria had a very diverse population in senses, religious, ethnic, and philosophical, and a high tolerance for individuality. I was never excluded from male-dominated public life, and I was always invited into female-dominated private life, something the men amongst us absolutely were not. But what about the alcohol? Isn't that why I opened a wine bar? Yes. Alcohol can be a perfectly normal part of life in these largely Muslim countries. Not all Muslims eschew alcohol, but of course, there are also Christians and Jews and Druze who live there as well. Syria is where I developed my love for the ritual of Arak, pouring the noble, honest-flavored spirit in a clear glass, dropping in a single ice cube at a time, slowly pouring in water so the liquid turns white. That's a lovely, lovely ritual. It's awe-inspiring to drink a beer at the Ottoman railroad station in Damascus, or to sip Lebanese wine on the rooftop of a 14th century stone house in Aleppo. Seeing the moon over the same citadel that had been survived attacks from Sasanians and Mongols. Traditional gin and tonic gained a certain cachet for me when garnished with mint and sipped on a hot July evening watching the sunset over the Euphrates. These experiences impact my life greatly and positively, and I absolutely thrive on them. It is one reason I continue to work in archaeology, despite being unable to go back to the country where my heart lies, which is Syria. It's also why I became a restaurateur and opened first Jet Wine Bar. Not everyone has the desire or ability to experience such adventures or to visit Syria, Iraq, Oman. But I could bring my perspective on the world and connection to other cultures to Philly through the food I ate and the wine I drank. I could show that great wines come from Lebanon, Armenia, and Turkey, that mahamra and kremtum belong on the meze tray. Mostly, I could share that Syrians and Kurds and Iraqis are caring and friendly people who connect around food, just like you and I. I'm still thrilled to bring grapes like Hungarian Ufark, Turkish Okuz Guzu, to Jet, inspiring people to learn about the culture and history behind the wines and their makers and their rituals of eating and drinking that connect us to the world and them. Hopefully, these inspire others to seek out the unknown and embrace the chaos that links these worlds, not just of archaeology and restaurants, but them and us, and brings me so much joy. Thanks.
Thank you, Jill, for sharing your travels with us. Before we get to our panel, let's hear a word from Kerrygold. Hi, everybody. It's Carrie Diamond here to talk to you about Kerrygold cheese and butter. I traveled to Ireland this summer to learn more about Kerrygold, the family-run dairy farms they work with, and the beautiful cheese and butter made from their grass-fed dairy. I hung out with cows for the first time in my life. I visited a picturesque cliffside farm in the southeast of Ireland overlooking the ocean. I walked on a lot of grass. I ate a lot of scones slathered with Kerrygold butter, which is truly the color of sunshine. I learned how Kerrygold tests and grades its famous cheeses, from its award-winning reserve cheddar cheese to its nutty and robust Dubliner cheese. I also stopped by Beechmount Farm to learn how they make my favorite, Kerrygold Cashel Blue Irish Farmhouse Cheese. You should definitely plan a visit to Ireland to get a taste of this beautiful country. Or you can just visit your favorite grocery store. For more on Kerrygold, visit KerrygoldUSA.com. Please welcome restaurateur Ellen Yin, Philadelphia's dynamic duo, restaurateur Valerie Safran and chef Marcy Turney, chef Justine McNeil of Fiore Fine Foods, and Tess Hart, owner of Triple Bottom Brewing.
So we've got some panel questions. Ellen, since you're next to me, we're going to start with you. If you had to describe yourself in one word, what would that word be and why?
So I think the word would be resolute. My boyfriend, who many of you probably know, he says that I'm like a bulldog. So, you know, I grab onto something and I can't let go. I think that tenacity and being resolute is really something that as an entrepreneur of any business that you have to have, because there's just so many challenges. Justine and I were just saying, sometimes you just feel like there's so many challenges that you feel so overwhelmed, but you don't have any choice. So for me, I just keep pushing and keep plugging along. And I guess that's why I think that stubbornness or that refusal to like give up is really important.
Resolute, that's a good word. All right, Marcy, your turn.
I'm gonna give you two words, controlling and then jack of all trades. At this point, if we have someone coming in to fix something that's going to charge me $300, how do you do that? I want to know how to do that. I've learned more just fixing or troubleshooting, you know, things that I think make me a better business owner, save me money, which is always good.
Valerie?
Efficient. Just every day, all day. Every single day, it's a constant. What needs to get done? We need to have Love Luck Kitchen done. Send me the prices. Just pushing, pushing, so I'm kind of annoying. But I get shit done all day.
All right, Justine, your word.
I think thoughtful is like the first word that would come to my mind. Like, I think because I'm a trained pastry chef, everything that comes to me is mapped out. Like, I don't ever just dive in and go off the cuff. It's like, I take this step and I'm like, okay, well, this would produce this, but then this would produce that, to the point where I overthink. I think it comes in handy in most situations where I don't ever just dive in and hope it works out. I've mapped it to a T, and then, you know, sometimes it doesn't work in my favor. Like, if someone gets hurt, I'm like, well, first, I should probably find this and that. I'm not, like, immediate, like, boom, boom, boom. But, I think the fact that I've, like, mapped everything out to a T means I'm always talking with some sort of knowledge behind the situation. Like, I'm never just putting out a recipe because I think it's good. I'm putting it out because I know where it's rooted and why it's going to produce this and how it's going to connect to people.
Great. Okay. Thoughtful. Tess.
I think my word is conscientious. I'm always asking myself, what is the right thing here? And then also, how can I do that right thing absolutely the best that I can? Manifested in high school when I learned we didn't recycle and I set up my own recycling bins. My parents probably wanted to kill me because they like loaded it up in their minivan every day after sports practice. And it's really come to light here in the brewery as a Fair Chance brewery and all the values that really drive what we do every day. It also means that I'm really hard on myself. So when we talk about the challenges, like Ellen mentioned, that every day it's just a challenge, I am always thinking about how I could have done that better and did I do the right thing in that situation. But I think conscientious is the word that fits me most.
I love how in all 12 cities that we've visited, we've never had panelists pick the same word, which is really remarkable. So, all right, Ellen, I would love for you to tell me and the audience what you do for your organization.
Nothing. Sometimes I just think I'm just wasting time all the time. I do. I'm like, what did I accomplish today? Nothing.
Not sure.
I think that, you know,
well, I know you're getting stuff done all day, I've heard.
When I had one restaurant, I felt really productive because pretty much I was like the GM. Mm-hmm. So even then, I wasn't really, I didn't produce anything. Like, I didn't produce a croissant. I just, you know, I'm so lucky. I just walk around listening to people telling me how great the croissant was, and I'm like, oh my God, Melissa, if you could only hear, you know, what people are saying about you. So sometimes I do think to myself, wow, this is really amazing. All these people coming together to like make something really phenomenal is a miracle. But I think that people look to me to be the arbitrator of what the brand is. So, you know, what do we represent? High Street Hospitality Group. You know, we always want to be the quality. We want to represent quality. So making sure that, you know, you have 4, 5, 6 super creative people. They all look at each other's Instagrams, and they're all a little bit, you know, looking at each other and thinking, oh, I want to do a little bit of that, or, you know, and I'm like, stay in this lane, stay in that lane. You know, we have a new chef at Fork, so, you know, trying to evolve Fork again. I mean, we just went through a 5-year cycle of great talent and people, and so I think my job is really to try to like make sure that each entity kind of has a mission, has a vision, and that they're keeping on target with that, and yet at the same time having a culture that weaves through the entire organization of values that people feel are important, whether it's sourcing, you know, you mentioned recycling. You know, we really feel sustainability is important, not just from like who we buy from. I mean, that's one of the most important, but like, I mean, silly little things like, you know, whether we're actually following through on our recycling plan or not on in different properties. So yeah, that's what I do.
Valerie and Marcy, how do you two decide who does what?
I would say in the last probably 2 years, about a year and a half ago, roughly, we adopted our daughter. So we tried to put things into place. We have a culinary director, we have a director of operations, so it was someone for each of us. So for me, the culinary director is the person in between me and the chefs at the restaurant. And his job is to inspire these chefs and work with them to change the menus. And he's very inspiring. And I feel sometimes like I'm kind of worried about the businesses, and I've got so much more that I'm worried about. So I think he's my outlet to them. And when we were going to become moms, we were like, we can't open anything else. It cannot be done. And then we're like, but this is what we love to do. So we have new projects and we can do it. And if we have these people in place, then it frees me up to do the kitchen design of this or that and the stuff that we really love to do and kind of create these new spaces. And I fix things during the day. That's what I do.
So, I mean, what was the question? Day to day was for Ellen.
How you two decide who does what?
Well, we're just different. She's kitchen, she's back of the house, I'm front of the house, I'm financial, business, all of that. So we never, I think that's why we don't fight, because we don't have time really. Like, we don't even talk it really in the day. Mm-hmm. And now, like, we're so tired that we still don't talk. We go home, we see Harlow, and we're like, all right, we go to bed now. But no, I mean, for us, we're going through a growth, and we're trying to figure out, we have a director of operations, and, you know, every day we're trying to figure it out. We don't have the answer. We have 6 restaurants. We're about to have 7. We're growing. We're, you know, trying to figure it out. But I think at the end of the day, what's good for us is, even if something isn't quite right, at the end of the day, you know, you can go to Marcy at the end of the day and say, okay, this menu item, is this going to work in this restaurant? Because we know we do 300 covers on a Saturday brunch. For me, it's something where, you know what, I'm going to can go to Val and there's an answer, because this is how we've done it for a long time. Or I say, you know what, we do need a new POS system. We do need to change, you know, our reservation system, whatever it is. So, you know, I can kind of guide that. I don't actually know how to use Toast now, right. But my director does, and I have people who do. So it's weird for me, because I used to know everything, and now I don't. But I have to have people who do. So we have to lead that. And we're not, I'm not a natural born leader. I'm a natural born doer. I just do it and do it. So it's hard for me to learn how to kind of, how do I communicate what I want? Because right now this isn't working for me. But I think we've grown at just learning. We don't cut corners. This is what we want. This is how it should be. If it doesn't sound good, tough. You're gonna hear it and we're gonna move on. So that's how I roll.
I'm gonna say, it is hard changing and keeping relevant for people who have had restaurants for a long time.
Yeah, well that's the other big thing. Like, nothing is constant. Every day is new. And we have to be new too, otherwise we're gonna be old. And we are old.
Well, you two and I have talked about this. You really don't get an award for keeping a restaurant open for 10 years.
No.
You know?
No, no. And our award is at 7:30, every restaurant is full. If it's not, I'm not sleeping well that night. That's how I judge our success. So, anyway.
And just to clarify, when you say Toast, is that your point of sale system?
It's just a new system that I'm trying to learn, and I'm like, oh, this sucks.
Justine, it's your turn. So I was looking at your biography, and I was like, wow, you've worked at a lot of male-centric places in New York. So I was curious, the move to Philadelphia, did you decide you were going to run your restaurants in a different way from what you had been part of, or were you taking bits and pieces of them and putting them through your own filter?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's interesting because you're completely right. I did work in a lot of male-centric places. However, I've always been in pastry, which is predominantly female-centric. So I've only worked for one male pastry chef, Brooks, at Del Posto. Otherwise, I've predominantly worked for females in female-dominated departments. I have worked for a lot of men with a degree of separation. So when I came here, I mean, always in my mind is like, I like having the best people. You know, it's never like I'm going to only hire female or I'm going to go 50-50 or this or that. It's always going to be the best people, because I do think that the right attitude just balances everything. However, the first call I made was my former sous chef, Gina Nalbone, who was with me at Del Posto, and she was out at Squirrel in LA, and I was like, come do this with me. And it was kind of like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm going to do something though. And she's like, all right, keep me posted. And then finally when we found the space, I was like, all right, we're going to do this. And she's like, I'm coming. And I'm like, yes.
Awesome.
Yes. So she got there. And so we were already 2-1, my husband. So we were like, all right, this is female dominated. So like, you know, it's always like, you know, the more women I can get in our departments, the better, because, you know, women don't always have the opportunities, but it's never like fully conscious, like it's going to be all female. But it ends up right now, we're probably honestly 50-50 at our restaurant, female to male, and that's just on it, like full honesty, who came through the door, who fit the job, and who balances who. It really is about personality. We try our hardest to hire nice people. Like, you know, if their skills are not up to par, like I can teach that, but I cannot teach being kind to each other, being, you know, respectful of each other and drive, like that you have to come through the door with. So that's always what I look to first, you know.
Okay. That's amazing that you pulled your former colleague from Squirrel, because Squirrel's a big deal out in yeah. Los Angeles. So
yeah, I couldn't believe it. I had hoped and dreamed.
It says a lot about you as a boss that she was willing to come here.
I don't know. I mean,
here.
The East Coast is just the best, isn't it?
All right, Tess, your turn. So you have such an interesting background with your Master of Environmental Management degree. How did you wind up working at a brewery?
That's the question, I think. Before going back to grad school, I worked in community development, and I also was getting very into craft beer. And really, more even than craft beer, though I obviously love beer, it was craft breweries. It was these spaces of community. They became community centers wherever they were. And studying social justice and workforce development and all of these other sort of community development themes in my work, I just sort of, along with my husband, who is in the back taking photos right now, who was also doing community development, we just started sparking these ideas of how this thing that is inherently a center of community could become so much more a part of a community if it was built with really great intention. And it could also be such a joyful contribution to community because beer brings people together. And so that was an idea that we sort of carried with us into grad school, and we're workshopping here and there. And I'm originally from Philly and wanted to come back here and was seeing so much opportunity and so much need for a business like ours with a Fair Chance mission. And Philly, for those who don't know, I think probably everyone in this room does, but Philly has the highest poverty rate of any big city in the US. And at the time that we were starting to think about starting a brewery, it also had the fastest growing millennial population of any city in the US. And so we, as a business, were speaking to both of these trends because our team members, many of them have overcome tremendous barriers to be with us. We have some really amazing nonprofit partners who help us meet our team members. And we're making beer, which, like, stereotypically millennials love, but it's true. And a lot of other people love it too. And so that is what drew me to breweries, was this opportunity to be a really strong part of a community.
You use the term Fair Chance mission. It's the first time I've heard that term. What does that mean?
So that means that our team members come from a huge diversity of experiences in Philadelphia, and that we are very intentional in cultivating a space where all of them can grow and thrive. So some of our team members have experienced homelessness, some of them have experience in the justice system, and all of them, no matter what their experience is, get a chance to grow here, do internal internships, and contribute and be part of the team.
Great, thank you. All right, our next question is, since this is the Food for Thought tour, one food-related topic or issue that is foremost in your mind these days. So Ellen, we'll start with you. What's keeping you up at night?
Well, definitely, I think everybody in this room knows that Philadelphia has a major, the whole country has a major shortage of folks who are in the hospitality industry. And Tess, what you're doing is amazing because, you know, bringing people who haven't been in the fold and who have the potential. I think, you know, I agree with Justine 100%, is that I'm not particularly looking for women or men. I'm looking for people who have that initiative. And if they have that initiative, whether they've been in prison, whether they've been, you know, homeless, I agree with you. I think that they should be given a fair chance. And I think Philadelphia is great because I, you know, one thing I admire about so many people in this audience is that they have a mission. Many of you have a mission of things that you believe in, and you're following through with it in your own organization, whether I was just talking to Hannah about sexual harassment or, but I think equity in the restaurant in general, I think is a major topic. And bringing people in, you know, hospitality together, programs like that, CCAP, you know, all these programs I think are really important. And I think that a restaurant is a community place.
Marcy, how about you? What's foremost on your mind?
I would say what's foremost on my mind is, we were talking about this on the way over, and I was like, just be honest. And I'm like, I think
right,
just,
we're in the nitty-gritty of running restaurants.
we're about to open something that is scary for us, is unfamiliar to us. Love Luck is in a place where we go at night and no one's there, except for right now it's Christmas Village. So just food related, I mean, what you said, it's, you know, bad, it's, you know, food waste that's on everybody's mind. I am literally trying to figure out what menu to put in that restaurant, honestly. And people are like, what's the food gonna be? I'm like, I don't freaking know. Like, it is such, it's like daunting, you know? It's in this weird place and we walk there at weird times at night and there's gonna be tourists and there's gonna be Philadelphians and it's just, it's crazy. Like, that is literally, she's up at 4 a.m. texting me and I'm already up downstairs on the computer. And that is literally like what we're trying to figure out is what, you know, what to do there.
What made you decide to do the project?
The building is awesome.
Okay.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, yeah. And for us, it's like you can keep opening restaurants. If we're going to open something, we want it to be something special. And it's a special location. You know, we live two blocks from there. It's totally iconic. So, you know, opening restaurant after restaurant after restaurant is, at some point, it's tiresome. But if it's special, then we want to do it.
So, Valerie, is your answer the same?
I think, you know, a big part of food, and again, this isn't necessarily food, but everything is related to people. So we're trying to figure out, again, how do we have, you know, somebody who we hired 2 weeks ago who's new, how do they become a leader, you know, as a manager for me, and how do we work with them? So much of it just revolves around the people who are there. So we're kind of day in and day out trying to improve that culture because it's hard to find people. It's hard to find good people. It's hard to retain them.
Justine, what's top of mind for you?
So it's not specific food, but in a broader sense, just through restaurants, is, so I've worked in a lot of restaurants where the kitchen culture was okay or bad or not great. So everything on my mind every day is how do I create a healthy kitchen culture? We're still so new and we can't put in everything into practice that my long-term goals are, but how do we make it so every day people aren't dreading their commute into work? Because I've been there. I've been on the subway platform crying. You know, and how do we make sure that doesn't happen? And how do we make sure people are supported every single day and their opinion matters and they want to come back to work? There's so many goals that I want to hit along the way, but every day it's, and another thing onto that is I'm coming from a complete back of house perspective. I've never worked front of house before. This is the first time I'm dealing with front of house money, and it's a disparity between front and back of house. I don't think it's as bad in, you know, casual dining environment that I'm currently in, but coming from fine dining, it was extreme. So it's kind of trying to figure out a way to, how do we get it so the cooks are fiscally appreciated, so the front of house is appreciated. I think American tipping system has a long way to go to merge those worlds together. I'd like to figure out that along the way.
Tess, how about you? What's top of mind?
So we're less than 3 months old, so everything is. And sleeping is top of mind, so it would be nice to do that someday. But I mean, I really echo what Ellen said. And then I also think about the space that we're creating, not just for the team that we have working here, but also for all of the guests who come in. I think in the brewing world, which is a wonderful collaborative community, but it is also male dominated and is also dominated mostly by white folks. And so trying to create a space where people who don't look like your typical flannel wearing bearded beer drinker feel comfortable and want to come in again and again and have a good time. We're just constantly shaping what that is and learning from our community and our guests about what we can be doing better to continue to develop a space that is welcoming to everyone, and that's really hard. And so that's something that we think about all the time.
I didn't realize you've only been open 3 months.
Oh, yeah, we're
babies. Yeah. You are a newbie. Oh, my gosh. All right. We're going to do a little speed round now, Ellen. Your favorite thing to make, bake, or cook?
I'm addicted to Vietnamese rolls. They are really fast, and I just love slipping the rice paper into water and then wrapping whatever, leftovers, rice noodles, basil, whatever.
All right, Marcy, your favorite thing to make, bake, or cook?
Anything braised right now with this weather, I love. One pot meal, easy and quick.
Okay. Give us a tip, like what would you throw in that one pot meal?
What would I throw? Right now I would throw some parsnips and scarlet baby turnips and, you know, whatever you have. You can cut it all the same, right?
Sure.
Nice bottle of red wine in there. And yeah.
Yum.
Invite some friends over, you're good.
Okay, what protein would you throw in there?
Short rib if it's for this one. Lamb maybe if it wasn't for this one.
Valerie, how about you? Favorite thing to make, bake, or cook?
I don't cook. I recently mastered turkey meatballs because they're good for Harlow, and that's it.
Okay, that's something. Justine?
Gelato. Gelato and sorbetta, that's my all-time favorite throughout my whole career. It was always figuring out how to get on that station and then mastering it. I love starting from like the plainest base to adding, and mix-ins, and eating it's my favorite
What's
part.
What's your favorite gelato?
Rocky Road's my all-time favorite. It's the best.
I have to say, they're really, really tasty.
Yum. Okay. Do you have gelato on the menu? I'm guessing with three pastry chefs, you must have some gelato.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great. Always.
Tess?
This is embarrassing sitting next to a pastry chef, but I love to make... It's called a chocolate souffle. It's never once come out like a souffle is supposed to, but it's always really good, and it's the thing that I make for birthdays, and it makes me feel like I'm celebrating something.
Your favorite thing to eat or drink in Philly that is not connected to you personally or professionally? Ellen, pressure.
I'm addicted to Pizzeria Bettia pizza. I'm sorry. I've been there more than any place else in Philadelphia lately.
What's your order?
Mushroom pizza, the white beans, and I love his salad with the fish sauce.
Marcy?
Turkish tahina shake.
From?
From Goldie.
So good.
Turkish tahini shake.
It's Turkish coffee tahina shake, yeah.
Okay. Vegan.
That's all I care.
Sounds great.
Valerie?
Cinnamon bun from Cake Life in the parking lot, in the truck alone, so nobody, I don't have to share it with anybody.
Thanksgiving Day, when she goes to pick up the pie and the cheesecake, and I just found out up front about 30 minutes ago.
I don't like to share those kinds of things.
We're learning so much about you tonight, Valerie.
Me too.
Justine?
We go basically once a week, sometimes twice a week, the diner in Fishtown called Solomay's. It's just this amazing little diner that we stumbled into and became our ritual, and the breakfast is out of control. It's so good. They're only open for breakfast. They close at 2. I go every week. My order is boring because I just want the same thing every time, and the server there makes fun of me every week, and that's totally acceptable, but it's just the best.
All right, you're a chef. You have to tell us what this boring order is.
Oh, I just get their 2 eggs, toast, and bacon. That's all I want. Or pancakes, you know. I really indulge. Wake up, go there on my Monday. We're closed Mondays. Go home, sleep for 4 more hours, and then go to work on the computer.
Tess, how about you?
There's a great taco place called El Puerto Pecha just a couple blocks away, and their carnitas tacos got me through very long months of construction here when we were like literally laying the rebar in the floors ourselves, and they are still, it's such a treat. They're so good.
Thank you to our speakers, our attendees, and to Tess Hart and her team at Triple Bottom Brewing for hosting us. A big thank you to Kerrygold for supporting our tour and providing us with beautiful butter and cheese at each stop. Our show was produced and edited by Jess Seidman. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.